From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The war has started, and so far there is a pervasive feeling of deja vu as we hear talk of the Basra Road surrendering Iraqi troops and even Peter Arnett. What's different this time versus the 1991 Gulf War is that we aren't just hearing about the night skies over Baghdad, we are seeing them in real time. The number of journalists in and around the region is estimated to be more than 700. Those in Baghdad are at the mercy of the Iraqi government, of course, and there are concerns that they could eventually be taken into, quote, protective custody. The International Federation of Journalists, an organization that represents more than 500,000 journalists around the world, sent an 11th-hour appeal last week to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and to the Iraqi administration. The appeal asks for the leaders in this war to give instructions to army commanders to respect the rights of those hundreds of journalists and media staff. Sarah DeYoung is the human rights officer for the IFJ based in Brussels. When I spoke to her Thursday, she said that the power of the Iraqi government to take reporters hostage worries her greatly.
That is definitely one of our major concerns, that the Iraqi authorities will use all foreign journalists as human shields. Of course, we're very concerned about that, but the Pentagon themselves are very concerned about that as well, even though they have apparently expressed the fact that they're unwilling to take responsibility, should that be the case.
In fact, President Bush did explicitly warn journalists twice in nationally televised addresses to get out of Baghdad, presumably because they're in some great peril.
That's right. We have ourselves appealed to all foreign media currently still in Baghdad to get out as fast as they can, and we're really appealing to them to get to secured locations. But at the same time, we're quite conscious that nobody can force a journalist to do so and that journalists are there voluntarily.
Now, there are Geneva Convention protocols concerning journalists and their protection, but neither the United States nor Iraq have formally ratified those protocols. Tell me what they are and why hasn't the United States signed off on that?
What they are basically is that they guarantee the basic rights of journalists, that they are neutral civilian observers, and so therefore it is said that journalists should not be harmed in any way. They should not be treated as prisoners of war. They should be allowed access where possible and, of course, guaranteeing the safety of everybody involved. Why the United States has not signed off on that, you're going to have to ask the United States government on that. I suspect it is because these clauses do deal specifically with civilians being treated as POWs, so that might be a reason why they have not signed off on those.
On March 8th, the Kuwaiti government warned foreign media against cooperating with Israeli news media and threatened journalists with legal action if they did not heed the warning. Now, about 1,000 journalists from around the world are accredited to be in Kuwait with the Allied forces, but not one of them is an Israeli. Is the IFJ doing anything about this government-sponsored censorship and boycott of an entire nation's press corps?
Well, the only thing that we can do is to what we are doing is publicly protest against this. At the same time, we recognize that a lot of the Middle Eastern countries and some of the Gulf states still have not normalized relations with Israel, and any Israeli citizen is not allowed to travel in these countries, so it doesn't matter whether you're a journalist or not. But we think it's absurd for a government, you know, to try to stop the flow of information between colleagues in general. It's just, you know, totally unacceptable. So it is the IFJ, together with the general press freedom community, of course, will raise their voice against that.
Your organization issued this appeal to both the United States and Iraq. Have you gotten any reaction so far?
Unfortunately, we have not received a reaction so far. And I'm sorry to say that we don't necessarily expect one either.
Has any appeal by IFJ on behalf of journalists during wartime gotten any kind of response, either stated or implicit?
Absolutely. We had a very interesting exchange during the 1999 bombing of Belgrade by NATO, where we had absolutely demanded do not target the national broadcaster, which is Radio Television Serbia. And we got some sort of guarantee from the NATO Secretary General, who at the time was Javier Solanas, you know, saying, oh, don't worry about it. We don't intend to, you know, target it. It's not a target. And then they went ahead and did it anyways. And unfortunately, 16 media staff were killed during that bombing raid. We've seen also, unfortunately, in Afghanistan that apparently a stray missile had hit the Al Jazeera office in Kabul, if you remember. We do not believe that it was an accident, so we do see this as one of our most important calls, you know, to keep lobbying against that type of targeting. It's unjust. It should not be allowed under international law.
Sarah DeYoung, thank you very much.
No problem. Take care.
Sarah DeYoung is the human rights officer for the International Federation of Journalists. She spoke to us from Brussels.
The three big networks have pulled their reporting teams from Baghdad, though ABC and NBC are relying on freelancers. CNN has been expelled. As of Friday, NPR still had a reporter there, and so do several other American news outlets, as well as many foreign ones. But the prevailing trend seems to be to heed the president's warning and leave, if they can. Some reporters, including John Burns of the New York Times, have been hindered or detained by the Iraqi government. The Boston Globe's David Filipov wrote in a recent piece how he was thrown out against his will just before the war began. The Iraqi government demands that reporters use their satellite phones from within the Ministry of Information and surrender them at night before they go to bed. Filipov violated that rule. When I spoke to him earlier this week from Tehran, he explained.
They caught me using the phone from my hotel room. I had written a couple of stories that day. It was after midnight. When I filed that story, it was far away to the press center. Didn't know if I could get a driver, and I didn't think it made sense to carry all that equipment around. So I quickly set up, sent the thing, probably took 30 seconds to send it, and just hoped that the signal wouldn't be something that they'd notice. And evidently they did.
Were you surprised by the sophistication of the surveillance apparatus at work here?
I wasn't that surprised. The Iraqi government is well known for using high-tech methods to keep control, cameras in the room, tapping phone conversations, any of those things in tandem with people outside looking for the signal would have helped them. But I think the main thing that tipped them off is that I had kept my satellite phone bag in the press center sort of to keep them from getting suspicious. And when I went in that morning, my bag had been opened, the lock had been picked. They'd seen what was inside it without my satellite phone, but a scale that I'd bought that I'd put in the bag that looked the same and weighed the same.
You gave them a dummy sat phone.
Yeah, it worked for 2 weeks.
You had clearly decided that the Iraqi restrictions on reporters were impossible to follow, but do you worry that you might have made it harder for your fellow reporters who are still in Baghdad? Do you think that what happened to you is going to cause them to be monitored more closely?
I think that people were already being monitored more closely. What happened to me gave everyone a clear signal that the Iraqis take it seriously. And the day after I got thrown out, there were piles and piles of satellite phones in all the official places where they're supposed to be kept. So I would prefer to think that I provided everybody with a perfect example of how they should behave and that everyone was able to take advantage of that and hold on to their satellite phones.
This wasn't the first time that you've been based in a city on the brink of war. How does Baghdad compare to experiences you've had as a reporter in other places?
Well, when I was in Grozny before it was attacked, Grozny and Chechnya, yeah. Both times there, you could tell it was coming. Everything seemed so ominous. People were running around with weapons. People were getting ready. Everyone was talking about it. Baghdad, the last day I was there, people were going out of their way to ignore the sandbags and ignore the police on the street with weapons, ignore the anti-aircraft guns, and go about their business. You start talking to people, and they're friendly. They're interested in talking about things other than the war. It was amazing how little enmity the ordinary Baghdad resident felt towards me as an American journalist and how far away the war seemed. You know, part of the problem is in that society, they can't have seemed to be too worried because they've got to worry about how they look. There are so many government minders and government watchers around. People worrying too much too early might have gotten themselves in trouble.
In the piece you wrote, you said that one Iraqi official made a rather wry statement as you were being shown the door.
Yeah, he essentially pointed out that I was being thrown out so they could make their point They want all the journalists to be filing from one place, and that place is the Ministry of Information. There's two reasons why they want everyone there, so that they can keep tabs on all the journalists, and also in the hope that the U.S. and its allies won't attack that building, which is apparently a vital building. Then that same official made a wry comment that I'll probably be back in Baghdad in 3 weeks on top of an American tank, and I can take my phone back.
So, David, where do you go from here?
With any luck, I'll be passing through to northern Iraq, British-controlled northern Iraq, and maybe in 3 weeks I'll be back in Baghdad to pick up my satellite phone.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Boston Globe reporter David Filipov has since left Tehran and found his way, as he intended, into northern Iraq.
And now for a few of your letters. Dan Helzer wrote in to thank us for our piece examining what seemed like the media's passivity during a recent White House news conference. Unfortunately, he writes, as the war heats up, we can expect more instances of sycophantasmagorical, he asks us to excuse his purple neologism, media treatment of government officials and military representatives. I fear that no matter how insupportable their assertions, the White House press corps is not going to ask the obvious questions their audiences so strongly desire to have answered.
Dan Lichty of Normal, Illinois writes, what sad irony there is in hearing about the widowed Haitian radio director who shut down her station in the face of constant death threats, and how other stations there have picked up the ball to make the silence of this absent station deafening. In the same program, we hear about American White House reporters softballing Bush because there might be career blowback, how Norman Ornstein rules the Rolodex world because he can be counted on to give predictable sound bites, and Stephen Moss talking about opinions for hire. Perhaps what we really need is for the journalism schools to shut down in New York and D.C. and to reopen shop in Puerto Prince.
And finally, this from Paul Palmera in Warwick, Rhode Island, writing about a mistake that I made. He says, Bob Garfield, speaking metaphorically in his piece Rolodex Journalism, says that Norman Ornstein, an oft-quoted non-government source for reporters, should be listed as O-negative, the universal donor. But in blood types, it is O positive that is the universal donor. I enjoy your program on WRNI.
And we enjoy your letters, so keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please, don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, for news junkies who still have questions about the war, some websites that may have your answers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the past 3 weeks, we've been keeping tabs on NPR's John Burnett, a reporter embedded with the command battalion of the 1st Marine Division, which as of Friday was camped a few miles south of the Iraqi border in Kuwait. John has allowed us to look backstage, so to speak, at what seems to be a precisely choreographed campaign. When we spoke to him Friday, he had just returned from a trip across the border into southern Iraq.
We actually got into, quote-unquote, liberated Iraq, into this little border town of Safwan, and we got to see the first evidence of the American liberation of Iraq and what the reaction is, and it was very, very interesting.
I noticed you used the word liberation in quotes the first time and then removed the quotes the second time. What do your eyes tell you about that word?
It's not so much what my eyes tell me about liberation as what the eyes of the Iraqis tell them means liberation, because they have heard U.S. commitment to their liberation before, and of course, we know how that turned out under the former President Bush. He hung them out to dry, and so there was a brutal repression of the Iraqi opposition, and particularly the Shiites in the south. So let's just say 8 hours into the liberation, there was bemusement, curiosity, and some subdued celebration among the Iraqis on the arrival of U.S. troops. The main thing that was happening is they were looting all of the large houses and offices in town, and the pathetic things that they were taking out of there, these old beat-up office chairs and old rusted-out refrigerators, and they were shuttling this stuff down the streets on their bicycles and in their carts. And then an interesting thing happened. An enormous convoy of unilateral photographers showed up in Safwan. The non-embedded journalists are unilateral. So the circus sort of moved to town briefly looking for the definitive picture. And the best picture they could get was a Marine reconnaissance lieutenant tearing off a picture of Saddam and holding it up. And the photographers just went, you know, like paparazzi just went crazy. And it was very interesting to me that it was not an Iraqi that was holding up and sneering at the picture of Saddam. It was a U.S. Marine lieutenant. And I think that tells us a great deal about, at least at this early stage, the tentativeness with which the Iraqis see the arrival of their liberators.
This wasn't a combat mission then. You just rolled in and there they were.
Well, because I'm embedded means that, you know, a Marine captain and a colonel took three journalists in. And so we went in surrounded by military, and we had to have our chemical suits at our sides. We had to have our bulletproof vests and our Kevlar helmets and all this stuff. And here's all the other unilateralist journalists all running around in T-shirts and jeans and kind of looking at us curiously. And it reminded me of being with my parents on vacation. And now you sort of look at all the other kids on the beach and sometimes wish you were running wild like them, but it was kind of secure and nice to be with your parents, too. The other reason I say that is because at one point there was a convoy of these unilateralist journalists on the highway, and we stopped to talk to them because I just wanted to see if I knew any of them. And they kind of panic-stricken asked our Marine driver, well, where is it safe to go? And should I go this way? And is Basra safe? And I know that feeling so well of being completely insecure, completely unprotected in a country that's totally lawless and just kind of wondering where is it safe. And frankly, when you're with the Marines, you feel safe.
As the war has begun, have you felt a conflict in what you say because of this feeling of security that you derive from your association with the Marines?
Actually, I have had no pressures whatsoever. I felt no pressures of someone hovering over me and worrying about my content. I've been very encouraged. And here's a great example of that. A couple of nights ago, the headquarters battalion that I'm embedded with had to move from its first position, which was Camp Matilda, to its current position, which is 8 miles from the Iraqi border. And so it moved in two enormous convoys. One was Alpha and the second was Bravo. Well, the Alpha convoy got to the new camp location just fine. The Bravo convoy that I was with got lost. And so about 110 vehicles took the wrong turn and went all the way to the Iraq border. They passed all these signs that said camel crossing, slow down. And then only when they literally got within about 50 meters of the Iraqi border did they realize, my God, this is the enemy. We're not supposed to be here. And so this enormous convoy had to all turn around, and the guy I was with who was driving our Humvee, he was very upset, and he was saying, well, by God, we could almost smell Iraqi aftershave. We almost started the war for Bush right then. And then it just got worse from there. The convoy turned around and couldn't find the new camp and got lost in the desert, and it was just madness. And then we finally pulled in about 4 a.m., and we were cold and exhausted, and I was taking notes the whole time. And there was, you know, there was no attempt to hide this obvious screw-up from me. So far, the Marines have been willing to, you know, to show their warts.
What about inside yourself, though? I mean, it's obvious you really like these guys and they're protecting you. Do you think that some judgment other than news judgment is going into what you choose to report?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel any constraints to say what I want to say. And if the time comes to rake them over the coals for an operation gone awry, that's exactly what I'll do.
John, I can hear in your voice how excited you are. It's a strange kind of privilege to be able to witness war from your vantage point. From our vantage point, we're watching buildings blowing up in Baghdad. We're hearing of civilian casualties. I wonder how any of that is filtering down to where you are, or if it is.
What's interesting is that I think when you come over here and when you embed with this group and you, in a sense, become sort of part of the project of the invasion and pacification of a country, you cease to hear the dissonant voices against that project until you tune into the BBC. And even then, you know, they're pretty muted. So, yeah, all I can say is the job of the 700 to 800 reporters who are embedded here is to report on what the military does. And frankly, I don't think we have access to the people who still disagree with this war. We're not going to have as much access to the civilian centers where there are going to be collateral damage and civilian casualties. And so we're going to depend on our colleagues tremendously to come behind us and to do that important reporting to find out how this invasion is influencing, you know, the people of Iraq and what they think about it. So, you know, once again, we see what we see and we don't see what we don't see in this operation.
Right. John, thanks so much for calling us.
You're very welcome, Brooke.
NPR's John Burnett is embedded with the command battalion of the 1st Marine Division, camped as of Friday 8 miles south of the Iraqi border in Kuwait.
As Americans watch the war unfold from their living rooms, there's a growing concern that despite the hundreds of reporters embedded with the troops and scores of others inside and around the battle zones, we may not be getting the full story. Well, never fear, the internet is here. There are websites to suit every type of media consumer, from policy wonks to gearheads to game players. Avi Zennelman, one of Slate.com's disgustingly overachieving high school interns, wrote a guide to war on the internet for Wednesday's edition of Slate. Avi, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
What was the coolest stuff you found in your search?
There is this website I found actually today after it was published, which has these weather satellite photos of Iraq. And this guy realized that there were oil fires about 3 hours before the mainstream media picked it up.
That website is www.methaz.com, M-E-T-H-A-Z.com.
Yes. Also interesting was this blog called Dear Ra'ed, which is actually written by an Iraqi Baghdad resident. And I actually have no idea how he gets it by Saddam. But on the webpage, it links to a March 16th ramble, how he kind of grudgingly supports the U.S. march to war. And he doesn't think fundamentalism's a big deal. But it's also just the daily life of a guy in Baghdad, which obviously is getting more and more chaotic.
Well, let's talk about the Middle East. Most Americans don't speak Arabic. But are there any Arabic or Middle Eastern websites in English that give us a kind of Arab view of what's taking place?
Yes, there's the Arab News website, which is a semi-official Saudi website, and it's very shrill, it's very propagandic, it's not really that reliable. More reliable would probably be Iran's webpage, the Islamic Republic News Agency, where they're actually probably been the best about updates about developments in the south of Iraq.
Speaking of reliability, the web is notorious for being an undependable, if diverse, source of information. You really don't necessarily know how much to trust what you're reading there. In your research, do you happen to check out the Israeli site Debka.com?
I didn't check it out, but I'm familiar with it because I know people who use it as a constant source. And most of the stuff there really isn't reliable at all. Actually, I think it's a former Israeli intelligence agent somewhere in like Tel Aviv or Jerusalem just typing what he hears.
Oh, well, he had a great scoop earlier in the week when he reported that Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz had deserted Saddam Hussein and had defected, in effect, to the United States and was being interrogated by U.S. intelligence officers. Of course, we suspect, having seen him on television later in the week, that probably wasn't true. For in-depth analysis or detailed discussion of military strategy or war technology, where would you direct web surfers?
Well, for military technology, everyone should check out globalsecurity.org. Their Target Iraq page has information on every single type of bomb we're using. They have terrain maps, which detail how the troops are going to get into Baghdad.
Everyone and his brother has an opinion, and blogs have proliferated. Are there any particularly trenchant weblogs on the subject of the Iraq war?
Actually, the best blog related to the beginning of the war is this blog called The Agonist. And from what I gather, he is an international relations student in Oxford, and he's been watching TV, checking his sources, checking the news wires, and has been doing rapid-fire updates online where he's getting the news quicker than CNN.com is getting the news, than a lot of the streaming radio and video sites are getting the news.
The site is www.agonist.org. Well, Avi, thank you very much for the tour. I'm just curious, which is the site that you've turned to the most since you started this project?
When I started the project on Monday through Wednesday, before the war, I was actually using The Guardian. But as the war started, I've been using the New York Times website a lot more.
Why?
Better writing. It seemed more detailed. Although I've been flipping back to CNN and actually The Agonist a lot just to see if anything new's going on.
All right. Well, Avi, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Avi Zennelman is an intern for Slate.com and a high school student. You can find links to these websites and many more, including political humor sites and Avi's article, The War on the Web. We have a link to Avi's piece at onthemedia.org. In Serbia, authorities have made more than 1,000 arrests in the course of investigating last week's assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. The sweep is intended once and for all to root out the corruption that has long dominated Serbian politics and much of the economy. No arrest was more shocking to Serbs, though, than that of the pop singer and sex symbol known as Seca, widow of the notorious mafia strongman and war criminal called Arkan. The post-assassination state of emergency has kept some details from the public, but it has been reported that police found a vast arsenal of illicit weapons in her home. Joining me now from Belgrade is Alexandra Niksic, a correspondent for Agence France-Presse. Alexandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we do anything else, tell me about Seca, who she is, how she got so popular, and what she represents.
Seca is probably the best symbol of what Serbia has gone through in the past decade. She's a singer of the worst possible music you can imagine. It's a combination of a national folk music through electronic equipment, and her voice is completely modulated. Nema vatre u kaminu da nas ogreje,
ni jačine u tom vinu da nas napije. Turbo folk, they call it.
Yeah, that's it. And besides these really tiny vocal possibilities, she has made her career with exposing the body, let's say. That's how she became incredibly popular. She even grew to a huge figure on the so-called Serbian jet set scene when she married Arkan, or Željko Ražnatović, who is one of the probably most notorious paramilitary leaders in Serbia. He was gunned down in Belgrade 2 years ago.
All right, so just to recap, Seca, whose name is Svetlana Ražnatović, is a singer of Britney Spears' level of popularity. She sings a sort of pop folk that has energized particularly the nationalist elements of the populace in Serbia. And she was married to an alleged war criminal and mafia leader in his own right, the notorious and late Arkan, whose real name is Željko Ražnatović. And they arrested Seca, the megastar, and found what in her home?
The investigation has not revealed all the details, but the reporters at the scene saw police pulling out military trucks full of arms and ammunition, as well as some military-type equipment for night vision. The house where she has been living since the marriage with Arkan is some sort of a castle. It's a four-story building surrounded with high walls, and God knows what else could be found down there. And when all these guys who were admiring her see that she could also be arrested, it would be a clear sign that no one could avoid this really big hunt in Serbia against these alleged organized crime bosses.
Tell me about the state of emergency. What effect is it having on journalism in Belgrade and elsewhere in Serbia?
Well, theoretically, it has the effect that you cannot really publish elements of the investigation if they are not confirmed by the authorities. On the other hand, except two daily papers, which were temporarily banned in the past week, everyone else seemed to be doing quite fine.
What about media owners themselves? Have any of them yet been caught up in this?
Not yet, except for an editor-in-chief of one of the weeklies, which was banned temporarily. This guy, his name is Grade Šakatić, and he was detained by the police briefly. This weekly, which has been banned, was a clear example of the forces loyal to Milosevic or to his patriotic ideas. And that is why not that many journalist unions here or even the readers of the press have complained about the closure of this media. So I would say that the government has been a bit clumsy in this attempt to control the flow of information from the investigation. Maybe the ban was not a good thing. But on the other hand, this is the first time that the authorities in this country are trying to do something against the organized crime.
In the United States, we are seeing an erosion of our own civil liberties through the war on terrorism, and the American public is not too upset about it. Do you think there's a parallel there, that the Serbian people are just so fed up with the mafia controlling every aspect of their lives that they'll live with a little state of emergency and some erosion of their civil rights?
It seems that everyone here believes that these measures were necessary. The only complaint you can hear is that why haven't they done it before?
Well, Alexandra, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alexandra Niksic is a correspondent in Belgrade for Agence France-Presse.
Coming up, a look back on war reporting from the Crimea to Kosovo.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, with war news round the clock, it seemed time to recall the history of war reporting. Last year, Brooke interviewed the acknowledged expert on the subject, historian Philip Knightley. Here's that interview again.
In 1854, a London Times reporter named William Howard Russell became a star as the first famous war correspondent with this account of the British Light Cavalry Brigade against Russian gunners in Crimea.
At 11:10, our Light Cavalry Brigade advanced. They swept proudly past, glittering in the morning sun in all the pride and splendor of war. With a halo of steel above their heads, and with a cheer which was many a noble fellow's death cry, They flew into the smoke of the batteries, but ere they were lost from view, the plain was strewn with their bodies. Through the clouds of smoke, we could see their sabers flashing as they rode between the gunners as they stood. At 35 minutes past 11, not a single British soldier, except the dead and the dying, was left in front of the Muscovite guns.
Russell was seen as the first practitioner of a great tradition, war reporting. But when he looked back on it all, Russell called himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe. The reason for that gloomy assessment can be glimpsed in a remark made by U.S. Senator Hiram Johnson in 1917. He said, "The first casualty when war comes is truth." Philip Knightley is author of the classic study of the foreign correspondent, The First Casualty. It's been released in a new edition, updated for the first time since it was published 27 years ago. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why, when summing up his career, did Russell call himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe?
I think he foresaw what was going to happen to that tribe. He foresaw that they would become, in their own way, propagandists for the government of the day. The military, who didn't like war correspondents right from the beginning, didn't want Russell along covering the charge of the Light Brigade because it brought home to a reading public, a greatly growing reading public, the horrors of warfare.
And it already began to change during Russell's career.
Yes, by the time that Russell was finished with the Crimea and moved off to the American Civil War, the power of the press with its war reporting had brought down a government in Britain and infuriated all the generals who up until then had reported their own wars.
Brought down the government in Britain?
Yes, the reports about the inefficiency of the supply requirements of the army, about the way that soldiers were left lying untreated or wounded on the battlefield, that led to Florence Nightingale going over to the Crimea in order to help these soldiers, brought down the government of the day.
Well, let's skip past the charge of the Light Brigade to the American Civil War. Now, the coverage there should have been extraordinary. Suddenly, reporters had access to this astounding new communications technology, the telegraph. But you write that it was covered miserably.
Yes, because already we can sense a certain corruption creeping in the way reporters reported. They began to realize their power. They began to charge various officers sums of money to give them a puff in the press, as they said.
But was that all? Was it simply that the reporters were after personal gain, or was there the politics of nations getting in the way?
Well, a lot was beginning to creep in. Politicians began to realize that nations fight as its people think, and that you can manipulate the way people think in wartime by clever manipulation of the war correspondents themselves.
Now, the twin forces of propaganda and censorship acquired a very modern efficiency during the First World War. Could you set the scene?
The scene was that the military by now, alarmed in the latter part of the 19th century at the power that war correspondents were displaying, revolted against having war correspondents around at all. And they announced that with the British Expeditionary Force to France to fight Germany, they would allow only 5 war correspondents, and they sort of incorporated them into the army. They said you can come if you can ride a horse, and that you will be given all the status of, say, a captain, and that you will have a batman and a driver and a personal censor, and we will show you what we think you should see. So you got none of the horrors of the First World War, you got none of the slaughter of the trenches. They said it's been a glorious day for Britain today, when in fact something like 100,000 people, 100,000 soldiers have been killed in one battle alone.
Now, that was a war when reporters signed on to the cause. They were committed to the Allied victory. But during the Spanish Civil War, there was a division between governments and among the press over who was right. There was no objectivity. There wasn't any middle ground. And most of the reporters sided with the Republicans.
They saw the fight there, the Republican government against the insurgents led by fascist General Franco, as being the beginnings of what later on became the Second World War.
Rumbling eastward this week from Aragon toward the sea in the mightiest offensive since the World War is the mechanized army of Spanish rebel General Francisco Franco. Tanks from the great German firm of Krupp, bombers from Italy's Caproni, Italian armored trucks, German heavy artillery, a crushing juggernaut that blasts its way through every loyalist defense, on toward the loyalist industrial center and seaport of Barcelona.
They saw the great battle developing between democracy and fascism. and felt that the Spanish Republican Army deserved to win.
And with the stakes so high, the first casualty is truth principle kicked in with a vengeance. And the reporters actively slanted their stories. They even made things up, both the pro-Republicans and the pro-fascists.
Yes. I mean, I can give you a good example of making things up. The denial of the bombing of Guernica. This was a bombing carried out by German planes working, fighting with the Franco-fascists.
Immortalized in the Picasso painting.
Indeed. There was a concerted move by the propagandists for the Franco side to make certain that the public got the view that this was an entirely invented story by pro-Republican reporters and that what really happened there was simply that the people of Guernica had destroyed the town themselves in order to blame the German bombers for what has occurred.
On the pro-Republican side, you spend a fair amount of time on the journalist Claude Coburn, who is a fine writer, but you saw his Spanish War coverage as a disaster.
He admits himself that on one occasion he sat down with a Comintern officer and a map of a town so as to make certain that they got the details right, and they totally invented a battle, which was won by the gallant Republican army against the hordes of fascists who had been storming them. He became so attached to what he felt was the right side that he lied in order to put that side in the best possible light.
You quote him telling his wife, with regard to the public's right to the truth, he said, "Who gave such a right? Perhaps when they have exerted themselves enough to alter the policy of their bloody government and the fascists are beaten in Spain, they will have such a right. This isn't an abstract question. It's a shocking war."
Yes, that sums up very well the way that he felt about it. Later on, other correspondents have said that they feel that the public right to know and the public right to objective or fair reporting can come back when the war is over. But in the meantime, it's necessary to win the war.
What about the coverage of World War II, the good war? From the standpoint of journalism, was it as good as all that?
No. I mean, I quote at the end of that chapter a Canadian war correspondent who'd been working for one of the big news agencies is saying, looking back after the war was over, he was appalled at what he'd written. He said, we weren't reporters, we weren't even historians, we were just propagandists for the Western side. But you see, in a war of national survival, it's very easy to get the journalist on side. You don't want to be accused of doing anything that might inhibit your government from winning what you and they consider to be a just war.
Departing almost to a split second on the right time, on a plan which they've been working and sweating and slaving at for months. The sky now is full of the noise of these paratroop planes as they circle the aerodrome before they take their course. But just as they're circling in the air, so the others that are waiting to go are circling the track of the aerodrome. Their lights moving around in a stately, steady procession. Aboard them are some of the toughest and finest and bravest men that we have in Britain. And they go out today to face their greatest trial.
At least the Germans avoided the hypocrisy of the Allied side, where the Allies pretended that these war correspondents were writing the truth and writing impartial reports and fair reports. The Germans simply herded all the war correspondents into a semi-army unit called a propaganda company and told them what to write.
Let's jump ahead to Vietnam. Now, that was the first time when reporters were actually accused of helping to hand victory to the enemy. Did they?
The American military certainly believes that's the case. I don't know what aberration occurred in the military mind in the Pentagon during the Vietnam War, but some aberration did occur because they decided they would trust the war correspondents to be on side. I mean, they'd been on side to a large extent in Korea, and they thought they would enjoy the same support from the press as they'd enjoyed there. So they just handed them on a platter a card that said, you can go anywhere you want, we will help you get there, we will provide you with rations when you are there, and you can write anything you like. But we'll rely on you and your good sense and your patriotic duty to write the story as you see it. Well, it worked for a while because most American war correspondents there did feel that the war was a just one, but they began to object to the way in which the war was being waged.
The long, wearying, and oftentimes baffling war against communist rebels in South Vietnam swung sharply toward a new crisis today. For the first time in the years-long struggle, the scene of action has shifted from the jungles and rice paddies to the sea and involved naval craft instead of guerrilla fighters. Hard on the heels of an attack Sunday and in the face of a warning from Washington, North Vietnamese torpedo boats opened an attack on two United States destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin today.
The public back in the United States learned the full truth about body counts, and they learned the truth about assassination squads, and they learned the truth about the deaths of innocent people. They learned the truth about various American atrocities. And this so sickened the viewer and the reader that they lost the will to continue the war.
War reporting changed after Vietnam, didn't it?
Yes, it changed amazingly for the worse. What happened was that military chiefs all over the world looked at Vietnam and thought, what lessons can we learn from this? And at a conference held in the Royal United Services Institute in London in 1975, I think it was, attended by representatives of the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense here, and a number of senior journalists, the question of, can we ever again allow color television cameras or any television cameras on the battlefield again and to cover a war, no matter how just that war might be? And the conclusion was a resounding no. So from that moment on, the Pentagon and the Ministry of Defense worked on a plan to manage the media in wartime. And it turned out to be a very simple but very effective plan. The military now controls access to the war. And nobody is allowed there unless the military takes you or allows you to go.
Grenada, Panama,
yeah,
and the Gulf.
And the Gulf.
We've been receiving some late reports from Baghdad that it appears airports and military installations near the Iraqi capital have been hit. What do you say about that?
This strikes me as an orderly way of shutting a country down. We are making war at all of Saddam's most important war-making capacities. The one thing I am not hearing is that we are not apparently making war on the innocent civilians.
You call the Gulf War the video game war. That's because so much of what we remember of that coverage are the reporters sitting in the briefing room being regaled with pictures of smart bombs that turned out, in retrospect, to have been
less smart than we think, yes. The military made it very difficult for war reporters to get to the front to see what was happening. They were taken on little conducted tours that were with the pool system, which all journalists hate. Pool system being a group of reporters that are selected or self-selected, and they are required to report for the whole of the media. And they're conducted where the military thinks it's safe to let them go, and they're censored. The major American media organizations objected to this and considered bringing an action while the war was on, claiming that this infringed their right of freedom of expression. But then their own rivalry among themselves led to the abandonment of that. And only the nation continued it, and by the time that they would have got a decision, the war was over. But the judge did rule that there was a case to answer.
Well, what about the coverage of Kosovo? There was plenty of reporting there that didn't suit government policy. There were some on-the-scene accounts. Was that finally good, unimpeded reporting?
Well, we're getting into a real minefield here about what is good, unimpeded reporting. Before the reporters got there, the government justification for what was happening had so demonized the Serbs that it became very difficult for any reporter not to join the mainstream stories of Serb atrocities. A lot of the war correspondents, mostly young and inexperienced, the quick story to do was, I witnessed an atrocity today, or I've discovered another mass grave. And they were known among the various independent interpreters there as the mass graves correspondents. It's quite possible in wartime to say, well, we've been showered, inundated with material, but very little real information. You had to look around for an old Balkans hand who understood the centuries of animosity that led to what had occurred, and follow him or her in order to get a real idea of what was occurring.
Your book is studded with stories of lucky and courageous correspondents who found themselves in the right place at the right time and managed to get the story through. And a lot of what stood in their way was simply the technology of the era. We have myriad ways to get words from one continent to another and out in front of the public. Shouldn't it be easier now to evade the kinds of obstructions that governments put in front of war reporting?
Satellite phones and navigational positioning devices and all that sort of thing make it much, much easier to get the story back. But what is the story? It is not difficult to manage the media in wartime. You provide them with almost unlimited information, but information that you want to get published. And you denigrate and slander any correspondent, like, for example, Peter Arnett, who attempted to report the war from the other side by staying on in Baghdad. Arnett was accused of being a traitor.
Well, Philip, I must say this has all been very reassuring.
Well, I know it's not very reassuring, but maybe we'll win through. But I'm afraid I'm a pessimist about the future of being war correspondents unless there is some major change in the way that the governments and the military view them.
Well, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Philip Knightley is the author of First Casualty, The War Correspondent as Hero and Mythmaker from the Crimea to Kosovo, now in an updated edition. He spoke to us last year from the BBC in London.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Brian Tilley. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support from the media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.